Hi, this is Bill Radke, and you're listening to Weekend America's MP3 podcast, and there's nothing wrong with that. But did you know there's a way to hear all of Weekend America, plus see pictures, videos, skip forward and backward through stories with better sound quality? It's the Weekend America Enhanced Podcast. And to subscribe, search for Weekend America in iTunes or go to our website and click on Enhanced Podcast.
Coming up on Weekend America.
Last chance for candidates in Texas and Ohio. But are they barking up the wrong tree?
We have pines, we have hardwoods, we have azaleas, we have dogwoods, and we have people that represent all those different kinds of things here.
The branches of the Lone Star family tree. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke. In Anchorage, it's a race to the bathroom.
I'm noticing that there's actually a seat on the inside with, yes, a hole.
Yes, and there will also be a roll of toilet paper in there for the race. The hand reading material. It's got to be an outhouse.
Okay, make that racing bathrooms. And later, a father starts a basketball team and finds a hidden talent.
My father would say in a booming voice, a stuffer for Stevens. And he would come up with these clever little sayings like, Dyson to Stevens to Thigpen to basket.
One Man's Hoop Dreams on Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in the Twin Cities. This is the first weekend for Will Ferrell's new movie, Semi-Pro. It's about a fake ragtag basketball team called the Flint Tropics. But Flint really did have a semi-pro basketball team in the early 1970s, and later we'll bring you their flash-in-the-pan story. What are you doing this weekend?
Well, we're going to a play. I think it's called The Contrarian Wife.
I'm getting married in about 5 weeks, so I'm putting together my invitations.
My grandson is 16, and he's in my house right now, and we're preparing for a family reunion.
I'm going to take my kids to a drum lesson. I'm going to practice my flute and hug my wife.
My wife is in the Air National Guard, and she is leaving for Afghanistan Monday, March 3rd. I plan to make it a very special weekend.
And we wish that for you.
Absolutely. Those voices came from Long Beach, California, Lincoln, Nebraska, and Nashville, Tennessee.
We're glad to have you with us. My name is Bill Radke. This is the radio program about what's happening in America this weekend. And this is the final weekend before Tuesday's big presidential primaries. Out of all the states a candidate could have to traverse in a short amount of time, Texas is about the toughest you could pick. It's not only gigantic, it's so diverse it's almost its own country. Besides the big cities, you got the bayous and piney woods of East Texas, the oil refineries and ports along the Gulf Coast, the vast rolling hills of central Texas, the sprawling border towns of the Rio Grande, the big sky country of West Texas, and the political terrain can be as varied as the landscape. We spoke with a variety of Texans from all over the state about the places they live and the issues that are important to them.
My name is Hilton Kelly. I live in the city of Port Arthur, Texas, on the Gulf Coast, and I am a community activist slash actor. What is life like? Life is good. Life is good. We eat a lot of seafood here. We got jumbo shrimp. We like dirty rice and even have bullfrogs and alligator. But we really have a great time on the Gulf Coast. The only things that we are really having to deal with that's not so great is industry. As you know, this is called Gasoline Alley, Cancer Alley, you name it, it's been called that. So the environment is important to us, climate change is important to us, and revitalization of our community is really important.
My name is Christian Bratton, and I live in Houston, Texas. I'm a born and raised Houstonian. My father is from India, and my mother was a ballet dancer, and I am a small business owner and a mother and a wife. I believe in Houston, it's really going to come down to the stance on immigration. I definitely think that right now it's John McCain for me. He was out there with Kennedy on the immigration bill. I was very excited. I thought we were going to make progress, and it was very disappointing to me that it didn't go much further than that.
Well, I think probably Iraq is my major concern, and then health care. I think we're probably one of the few Western civilized worlds or industrialized worlds who don't have universal health care. You can work your whole life and end up in a nursing home, and they take your Social Security and house and everything else, and you play the game right all your life. So I think that's tacky. Okay, I am Cletus H. Rattan, and I'm a professor of English. I'm a former Marine and a former cowboy, and those things probably affect my opinion as much as anything else. My primary home, which I keep, is in rather deepish West Texas. A kind of nice place to be. There are only about 3,000 people there, and so you can either head in a parallel park whenever you want to. Nobody cares. It also has the advantage that we never repair our streets, and so there's nothing clogging the traffic, if there were any traffic.
My name is Estela Sosa Garza, and McAllen is the town I live in, and it's one of 36 municipalities that are in the southernmost part of Texas that borders with Mexico. One of the important areas is healthcare. I can tell you from personal experience that I lost a brother because he did not have insurance, because he could not afford to pay for it, and ended up dying at 42, very young. And many families are experiencing this. So if it wasn't for the emergency room or if it wasn't for Mexico, I don't know what people would do.
My name is David Mays. I live in Longview, Texas, and I'm a pastor at a Christian church. I was a Vietnam vet. I was in Cambodia when President Nixon got on the radio and said, "We have no troops in Cambodia." And that was the first time in my life that I discovered that our government openly lied to its people. That really hurts because I think that represents who I am, and I just don't see telling bold-faced lies as a way to do business. So I think getting truth back in the office is what's important. What I like best about the piney woods, we have pines, we have hardwoods, we have azaleas, we have dogwoods, and we have people that represent all those different kinds of things here. And so it makes it an interesting place to be, and every day something is revealed.
David Mays is a pastor in Longview, Texas. Estela Sosa Garza works with Valley Interfaith in McAllen, Texas. Cletus Rattan was the Texas Poet Laureate in 2004. Christian Bratton is a business owner in Houston, and Hilton Kelly runs the Community In Power and Development Association in Port Arthur, Texas.
This Sunday, Russia will be holding its presidential election, but unlike here in the United States, the competition isn't exactly fierce. Dmitry Medvedev is expected to win. He was handpicked for the job by the outgoing president, Vladimir Putin. Russians living in the United States can actually vote this Sunday in their elections in Russia. They can just go to their local consulate and do that. Well, we thought we'd check in with two of New York City's 560,000 Russian immigrants, Katya Gaika and Ilya Marinzon. They both came to the United States to study, and they've been living and working here ever since. Ilya, who publishes a Russian art magazine, will be hosting a party this weekend. And I asked them if it will have an election theme.
Yes, we're shooting for themed martinis, like a Putin martini, a Medvedev martini, and we'll see how they turn out. We're still kind of working on the components.
What's going to be the difference between them?
I think Medvedev is going to be a little sweeter. I think.
But they're definitely going to be very dry, both of them.
Not stirred.
Will you be voting on Sunday in the Russian election?
I think I will. Not because I want to try to influence the outcome of the election. It's unlikely that I will be able to. But elections here are kind of a nice custom. You go to the consulate, you vote. Russian consulate actually happens to be, I think it's a territory of Russian Federation. So it's like going home for 5 minutes.
What about you, Katya?
I'm tempted to vote against everyone because, you know, just to be controversial for the sake of it. I almost forgot about our election because I was in such a fever with what's going on now in the United States. And then I realized that, oh, actually, we do have an election too.
Young people are really making a strong showing in the primaries here in the United States this year. Do young people vote in Russia? Is that a growing trend?
Generally, young public doesn't care about voting that much. But actually, for a young person, for a student, say, there is a good chance to make a career in politics. So those young people join some sort of political parties, and they are quite active, but it's definitely not a majority.
But, you know, the trouble with those organizations that they are often being paid to be there, and they're not really passionate. So it's not, it's a question, yes, we do have movement, and youngsters somehow are getting involved, but it's not the, you know, movement of a heart or social consciousness.
Yeah, it's totally pragmatic.
It's pragmatic.
But still, young people do take part in voting for different reasons.
Yeah.
Some get paid, some get food stamps or something.
Well, both of you then have been here long enough to experience now at least your second presidential election. What has surprised you most about the democratic process here in the United States?
Well, my surprise is that actually democratic elections happen to work. Coming from Russia, I saw the elections, but I couldn't believe that, in fact, people can effectively choose a leader through the elections. Plus, it's kind of an entertainment, too. And both parts of the process fascinate me.
You've used the word entertaining, that the American election is entertaining. Is that what you're talking about, like the level of engagement?
Well, to my mind, in the American elections, there is drama. You don't know the outcome, and that's why it's kind of entertaining. In Russia, there is one major candidate. It's heavy favorite Medvedev. And to Russians, it's really hilarious. There is no drama left.
Both of you have gone back to Russia since you've come to the United States. Politically speaking, how are you different?
I would say that I become less cynical in a way because I realized that what we have today may be what we need to have, and we being Russia as a country. We never had the history of fighting for a right to vote. The whole culture is not instilled in Russia yet. It's not a part of our DNA, let's say. So I realized it's not about me being educated and striving for a change and for better things. It's also about the rest of the people and what they need. And if they need to have a stability in food and supermarkets, and if today's government can provide that, maybe this is okay. And then couple of generations later, when people realize that, you know, there are other values that are, you know, even more important than stability, then they will build a better government. They will choose different people.
It sounds to me a bit, Katya, like they're in a process and the experiment isn't over yet. It's just beginning.
This is my hope. And that's why I'm trying to remain optimistic, you know.
While living in New York, of course.
While living in New York.
Of course, yes.
That was Katya Gajka and Ilya Marinzone. They're Russian citizens living in New York. You can meet them and find a link to Russia Magazine. Just go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
A glitch in the border fence, ignorant teenagers, and an ostracized kindergartner with a mohawk. Good news, bad news, no news. Next on Weekend America. Thank you. This is Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper, and the weekend is for pondering. You don't have to be an expert on the news to have a thoughtful opinion about it, something we prove every week in a segment called Good News, Bad News, or No News. With us this week, cognitive scientist and best-selling author Steven Pinker, joining us from Harvard U. Welcome, Steven.
Thank you.
Over at Yale University, we have literature professor Amy Hungerford. Hey, Amy.
Hi, Bill.
And Minneapolis journalist James Lilacs. Welcome, James.
Well, thank you very much.
Our first topic, the White House has delayed by 3 years plans for a high-tech virtual fence along the U.S.-Mexico border. This network of sensors and surveillance was a key to President Bush's proposed immigration reform, whereby the U.S. would secure the border and give undocumented people a path to citizenship. But the fence has been plagued with software and radar glitches. Is the 3-year delay good news to you, or bad news, or no news?
Well, I'm going to say no news.
This is Stephen?
This is Stephen, yes. Because anyone who's familiar with the state of the art in computer vision would predict that this is the whole idea was a pipe dream, that computers and image processing are very good for recognizing letters, for picking stocks, for playing chess, for all of the things that are at the limits of human intelligence, but the kinds of things that we do effortlessly every day, like picking up a glass or recognizing a face, are the toughest challenges for artificial intelligence systems. And so the idea that you could have thousands of miles of border automatically policed for the presence of a human form, and that computers could distinguish humans from coyotes and deer and foxes and so on, struck me as implausible from the start.
You never bought it.
Never bought it.
This is SDI all over again. This is the missile interception system all over again. So it seems that this radar would be really good at finding exceptionally large illegal immigrants moving very slowly, not trying to hide. And it was also good, apparently, at detecting the presence of illegal rain coming over the border from Mexico. So I think this is, though, terrible news, though predictable. We spent $90 million of the taxpayers' money, gave that to Boeing to do this when they should have known, as Stephen says, that it never would have worked.
It was rain that was here to soak the things that Americans were not willing to soak.
Well, I think if we had a problem with intercontinental ballistic immigrants, it would be the perfect system.
Sure.
It's probably good news for people who want an actual physical fence if they want to control immigration that way. They want a real fence. I mean, the experience that most of us have had with a virtual fence are those little posts that you find at the store at the mall. You walk through that thing and you can have 38 thong panties stuffed into your coat pockets and it beeps away and they'll just wave you on through because they're used to it having a false report every time.
You all sound so pessimistic about technology. Eventually, the administration says, you know, we'll work this out. It's a 3-year delay.
Well, I'm optimistic about technology, but I am deeply respectful of the tasks that a human brain can do, which we are nowhere near duplicating in computers.
Our next topic. In a new survey of American teenagers, fewer than half could identify Ralph Ellison's novel, The Invisible Man, and 1 in 4 said Columbus sailed to the New World sometime after 1750. The group doing the surveying says President Bush's No Child Left Behind policy emphasizes reading and math at the expense of literature and history. Is this form of teenage ignorance good news to you, bad news, or no news?
I think it's really no news, but what I find depressing and truly bad news here is that one of the books that students really did know was Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not a bad book, but what this signals to me is that literature has become the vehicle for a social message in people's understanding of curriculum. And it's not about the pleasure of language and that whole repository of knowledge about what you can do with language. And so I just hate to see that impoverishment of a whole body of understanding of language.
Bad news.
I think it's bad news. It may be no news in that we're used to bemoaning the idiocy of youth, but it's bad news to keep hearing again and again that this larger cultural heritage is being squandered and evaporating before our very eyes.
Stephen?
I'm going to say it's bad news as well, but I think it's a mistake to think that this is a problem of teenagers. And the worst news that I've heard in months was the story that President Bush's press secretary had never heard of the Cuban Missile Crisis. She said that she went home and asked her husband. She said, "Is this the same thing as the Bay of Pigs?" And he said, "We've got to talk." Now, the reason that this is scary is that the Cuban Missile Crisis itself was a case in which knowledge of history literally saved the world. Kennedy and Khrushchev were at loggerheads. Both of them sat back and reflected on history. They both backed down, lost face, because history had told them that the alternative could lead to a catastrophe. And the idea that the inner council of government could be spectacularly ignorant of probably the most important historical event in memory is deeply scary. That's bad news.
The good news that I can think out of this is that in 60 years, the teens today will be looking at their younger generation and bemoaning the fact that they think Star Wars 1 came out before Star Wars 4. They'll have a whole different set of cultural references that they're appalled that kids don't get today.
Okay, our final topic. In Parma, Ohio, a kindergartner with a spiky mohawk hairdo has been suspended from school for creating a distraction. His mother calls this discrimination. Is the expulsion, to you, good news, bad news, or no news?
It's no news. His mother needs to be expelled from the hairdresser's shop. This is my theory. Wow. It's his mother who chose that haircut the first time he got it, I will bet.
Yeah.
And this is not about his free speech. It's about a mother using her son to express something that she wants to have at large in the world.
A decades-old symbol of rebellion onto her kid's head. But is a mohawk really that shocking anymore? When six-year-olds are having them, I mean, is it really that even distracting?
It hasn't been shocking since about 78.
Right. So you have no problem with the appropriation of the proud Native American name for this?
That's a whole different question.
How do we know he didn't adapt the mohawk as a protest against the depredations of Thatcherism? We have no idea.
Yeah, we have no idea. Exactly. I'm guessing he did it for just that reason. Okay, that's the news this week. Panel, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Steven Pinker is the Johnstone Family Professor in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University. His latest book is called The Stuff of Thought. Yale Literature Professor Amy Hungerford is teaching an undergrad course with the intriguing title, What Haunts America? Journalist James Lilex writes a blog called The Daily Bleat, and his website currently features vintage and often bizarre advertisements and the history of cheesecake photography. And you can see their work and cast your own vote on what constitutes good, bad, and no news when you visit us at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
The Will Ferrell movie Semi-Pro opens this weekend, and behind the silliness is a real story of hometowns, immigrants, and basketball. And that's just ahead on Weekend America.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. This weekend, some people in L.A. will be thankful they have GPS. They can use it to help dodge that traffic bullet otherwise known as Sunday's Los Angeles Marathon.
Yes, but those on a tiny residential street in Secaucus, New Jersey, are cursing GPS. It has been sending tractor trailers down their street, which, by the way, has no outlet. So tractor trailers doing three-point turns at all hours of the day and night.
Well, mapping blunders are, of course, not new. Mark Mominier from Syracuse University studies maps and how we use them. Dr. Mominier, let's start with a simple question. If GPS comes from satellites, how do these errors keep happening?
GPS can still be wrong because basically what we're oftentimes doing is taking the coordinates that we get from a GPS system and we're putting them on an electronic map. And that electronic map typically, let's say, might be based on paper maps. Those paper maps might be wrong. There's a possibility that we might have features that were put in the wrong place on paper maps that were otherwise right. So consequently, errors happen.
So, Dr. Mominier, I want to ask you, what, in your opinion, are the top three map-making mistakes, which you would consider the hugest blunders in map-making?
I suppose we could go back in time and we could look at some early maps of the North American continent, and they showed California as an island. This fiction persisted for well over 100 years. It even lasted for a while after a Jesuit missionary walked from somewhere, I believe, in Arizona all the way to the Pacific Ocean.
So California is an island. That would be a biggie. What's another?
Back in the 1990s, when there was a war going on in Yugoslavia, when NATO forces wanted to bomb a facility in Belgrade that was a supply headquarters for the Yugoslav army, and they had a street address. The only thing is, they weren't really certain, you know, exactly what building that street address represented. They had some aerial photos, they had some maps, and somebody figured out that, okay, it's this particular structure there, which probably might have been a pretty good guess. Unfortunately, that happened to be the Chinese embassy. Mm. So they were basically using inaccurate cartographic sources. And this is really something that you have to watch out for because maps are items that have a shelf life. The surface of the earth changes. And if you're using an old map, you are simply inviting lots of problems.
What would be your third largest blunder in mapping?
The third one would relate to the incident that happened with Hurricane Katrina a few years ago. In 1965, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was designing a new flood wall, and they figured out how high this wall should be based on a height which was relative to mean sea level in 1965. Then they put out specifications for this wall based on maps that had a zero elevation back in 1929. Now, what happened between 1929 and 1965 is that the level of the land had dropped about a foot and a half. They had a flood wall that was built a foot and a half too low.
To disastrous effect.
Absolutely.
Professor Mominier teaches geography at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs. He said that this weekend he won't need maps or GPS. He'll be attending a home and garden show near his house.
This is Weekend America, and next weekend the NBA plays a rare do-over. Back in December, the Atlanta Hawks appeared to defeat the Miami Heat, except a Miami player was wrongly ejected when they miscounted his fouls. So the teams will replay the final 51.9 seconds to find out who really wins.
It's a rare second chance to do things over. So we wanted to know, what's an incident from your life that you desperately wish you could do again? Or maybe you actually got the chance to replay a situation. How did it turn out for you? Come visit us at weekendamerica.org and let us know your story.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
In Los Angeles, welcome to the show about what's happening this weekend. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Up in Anchorage, Alaska, the 2008 Iditarod kicks off today. 96 mushers are racing their dog sleds more than 1,150 miles across the last frontier. But last Saturday, Alaska's largest city was the site of another kind of sporting event. 17 teams convened on 4th Avenue, the same place where the Iditarod will start today, and they raced their own snow-going contraptions. Rebecca Shear of the Alaska Public Radio Network went to cover a sporting event where pooping out is not an option.
For veteran racer Robert Maxwell, it takes strength.
It's harder than it looks.
What's hard about it?
It's heavier than you would think it would be.
Rookie Jeff Lebersky says it takes skill.
What assets do you bring to the team?
A lot of endurance. I think if it's a long race, we'll be able to handle it.
It also, he says, takes engineering.
I'd probably have to say you'd want to put a lot of weight on the bottom and lightness on the top because I foresee spillovers, especially with Robert.
And when you're racing what these guys are racing, trust me, you don't want any spillovers.
I'm noticing that there's actually a seat on the inside with, yes, a hole.
Yes, and there will also be a roll of toilet paper in there for the race. Hand reading material. Yes, it's got to be an outhouse.
Yes, an outhouse. See, every year, Anchorage, Alaska plays host to something called Fur Rendezvous, a festival founded in the 1930s to celebrate Alaska's fur trade. These days, Fur Rendy includes events like snowshoe softball, a Mr. Furface competition, and, of course, the annual Fur Rendy Outhouse Races. The races began in 2006, sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage Architecture and Engineering Club, of which Jeff and Robert are proud members. The first year, the AE Club nabbed the first-place trophy, a miniature gold outhouse complete with a roll of two-ply. But in 2007, they skidded into a disappointing last place. So this year, it's make or break. Come back victorious or forever hang their heads in shame.
So we need, I think the two strongest are going to be on the furthest out so they can keep it straight. Do you think that makes sense, guys?
Yeah.
Two strongest people on the outside?
A week and a half before the race, the team holds a practice session in a snowy parking lot. They'll be racing in the unlimited division, so their racer looks more like a go-kart on skis with a toilet seat. It's covered in bright emerald paint and is named, ever so aptly, the Green Movement. With a helmeted rider white-knuckling the toilet seat, Robert, Jeff, and two other guys push the outhouse across the parking lot and back. The team isn't quite in sync. They don't have their groove back just yet, but at least they don't experience any of those spillovers.
Okay, can we go back inside?
That was it?
Nothing.
That's all? This major competition and you're only going to do one trial run?
We did twice as much practice as anybody else will do.
We're all Hollywood, man. We just show up and get the job done.
9 days later, they'll have the chance to prove that's true.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the outhouse races.
Game day, and the heat is on. Or off, rather, as the temperature hovers somewhere in the upper teens. Stepping onto the snow-packed race course, the Green Movement team sizes up its adversaries. There are 17 teams in all, including one representing the Air Force. Their steel and plywood replica of an F-22 fighter jet features a pilot in full regalia clutching a plunger/joystick. The lid on his toilet seat reads, "Droppin' bombs."
So you're seeing your competition. How you feeling?
I'm worried about that military team. They got a slick little aerodynamic rig. Yeah, they're ready to rock.
The teams go head-to-head for several rounds. The Green Movement's first race pits them against a cumbersome plotting outhouse, basically a walled platform painted with cartoons of cows doing their business.
Poopsie Daisy and Green Movement to the line. Here we go.
3, 2, 1!
The teams rush down the 85-foot course, but at the turnaround, there's trouble.
Oh, collision, collision, I'm being forced into the trailer. Oh, my
Still,
Lord.
The Green Movement comes out on top. Unfortunately, the victory comes with a price tag, as Robert bashes one of his fingers.
It hurts a little bit.
Dedicated team player. It's getting sort of purple and swelly.
Yeah, I can't move it.
With one finger down, the team loses some speed during the next rounds. And after racing against Stinky's Funhouse, a fatal miscalculation sends the Green Movement toppling over. And the team suffers its most embarrassing loss of the day.
Okay, Stinky's is the winner! Stinky's wins!
In the end, the Green Movement finishes fourth. No gold outhouse trophy for them, not even a bronze.
I thought a lot of teams came ready to rumble.
A few days later, Robert and Jeff reflect on what went down.
Good race. I suggest any racers out there just push it as hard as you can. If you can walk the next day, you didn't try hard enough.
Anything you would have done differently?
I would have moved my hand and won. That would have been good, too.
In Anchorage, Alaska, I'm Rebecca Shear for Weekend America.
We know you're flush with interest about the race. There's great slideshows of all the competitors. Just go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
This is the radio show about The American Weekend. The new Will Ferrell movie Semi-Pro opens across the country this weekend. It's a fictionalized look at a semi-pro basketball team trying to join the NBA. Will Ferrell is a coach, player, and owner of a team called the Flint, Michigan Tropics. Well, in reality, Flint is a huge basketball town. And in 1972, they had a real-life semi-pro team called the Flint Pros. The people who brought the team to Flint were Mike Rizek and his family of first-generation Lebanese immigrants. They didn't know a lot about basketball, but they liked the idea of Flint having a hometown team. Here is one of Mike's six sons, David, to set the scene.
My dad was from an immigrant family, and on our street, about half the houses were our family, our relatives. My father's brothers, sisters, first cousins, second cousins. We used to get together every Friday and Saturday night, and there were usually 30, 40, sometimes 50 people at my Aunt Helen's house, my dad's sister. They got together to do what they did in the old country, and that was to sit around, drink coffee, smoke tons of cigarettes and cigars, and just talk. It used to be almost like a think tank where they came up with great ideas. They came up with the idea of a pizzeria. They knew an unemployed worker from a local Pizza Hut or something, and they changed his name from Paul to Paulo, and they opened up a pizzeria. It was one thing after another. And so our parents and their first cousins really didn't know much about basketball or sports in general, but they had all normal kids who loved sports. The combination of their entrepreneurial spirit and our love for sports was the seed for the development of this concept of a semi-pro basketball team in Flint. The fans were ecstatic about having this team on the north side of Flint in this sleepy little community. The first several games drew almost 1,500 fans, and the Flint Pros won their first five games. And now there was an incredible amount of excitement. There was a player named Wardell Dyson. He was the 1970s version of Shaq. Justice Thigpen was a product of Flint. He was a scoring machine. Probably about the fifth or sixth game into the 72-73 season, the announcer for the Flint Pros was sick and didn't show up. Well, never afraid to try anything, my father said, I'll do it. When Justice Thigpen would score a basket, he would say something like, there's Justice. And he would come up with these clever little sayings like, Dyson to Stevens to Thigpen to basket. And the fans went wild over this. In 1972, Flint, Michigan was really a great place to grow up. But you could see the writing on the wall. The competition in the auto industry was going to start ramping up. You could see unemployment was just beginning to become an issue. And so at a time when Flint was beginning its decline, the Flint Pros was a reason for hope and a reason to be happy. It really did take your mind off the financial woes of the county. You know, after the first season, they believed that there was still something magic about this team. Now, they lost about $13,000 on the team after the team's wages were paid, the fee to the league was paid. So they figured they would move it downtown to the IMA auditorium. And then in the first third of the season, they lost $12,000. After the December 2nd game, which only drew about 177 fans, the pros decided to fold. And for my family, the end of the pros was very heartbreaking. It was something that we just absolutely loved. But being true to form, I don't think it was six more months and my father had another scheme up his sleeve. I think it was not long after the pros that he came up with the idea of starting a local Catholic church called Our Lady of Lebanon. And out of that kitchen at my Aunt Helen's house, a Lebanese Catholic church was born in Flint, and it still is a thriving Catholic community today.
Dr. Rysik hasn't seen Semi-Pro yet. He says he's looking forward to seeing the movie that features the fictionalized team, the Flint Tropics.
True to form, March is coming in like a lion for the folks in Maine and New Hampshire who could see more than a foot of snow over the weekend. For more weather, here's Weekend America's Brendan Noonan.
I've always been suspicious of fruit. Why do the seeds have to be on the inside? What are they hiding? That's why I like today's Florida Strawberry Festival in Plant City, Florida. It's partly cloudy and 80 outside, which the strawberry seeds already know, because outside is where they live. I respect that. The chill in Fairbanks, Alaska is good for today's World Ice Art Championships. Fairbanks is said to produce dense blue ice that's so clear you can read a newspaper through it. Well, today's high will be 0 degrees, so good luck turning those pages wearing mittens. And some people wouldn't go to the Penn Cove Muscle Fest in Coopville, Washington this weekend. Not because of the rainy 45-degree weather, but because bivalves are gross. Well, allow me to disagree. Inverse. If you want to be boringly fed, try a salad or yogurt instead. But for rapturous eating, there's nothing like feeding on something so recently dead, like a bivalve. For more information on these and other events, go to weekinamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Brendan Noonan for Week in America.
For some who are depressed, there's nothing like the talking cure. But for one suicidal young man, he didn't just talk about it. He did 52 things about it. Coming up on Weekend America.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at calvert.com.
I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. Welcome back to the show about what America is doing this weekend, like attending the True False Film Fest in Columbia, Missouri. It's a documentary festival showcasing new creative talent. And premiering this weekend will be a documentary called An Alternative to Slitting Your Wrists by Owen Lowry. It follows him around for a year after he attempted suicide. During the year, he checks off a list of 52 things he always wanted to do. The list was a mix of silly things like bungee jumping and squirrel fishing, but also serious things, things he'd been avoiding his entire life. Owen, thank you for joining us.
Hey.
How did you go from feeling like suicide
was one of the best options to making a movie about living.
Distraction. Distraction is the best opposition to depression. I was in the hospital. I was doing a lot of journal writing for the time I was there, and I remember writing that maybe I should just try to do some things. If I started feeling depressed and sad, just force myself to go outside and do something I've never done, because, you know, what's the point of dying if you haven't done everything you've wanted to do? So, you know, I wrote down a couple things that I wanted to do, like start and finish a movie. I mean, that's where the movie came from. And after writing that list of 52 things I wanted to do, you know, I kind of decided I had to use that same list to get into the things I had to do, to kind of conquer some of those inner demons, face some of the people from my past. I used it to quit drinking completely.
Was it hard to go through the next year without drinking?
No, actually, when you have a camera on you at all times, it's pretty easy because somebody can always see if you, you know, break the rules. It became hard after I finished the movie, after I finished shooting it. I was kind of facing all these problems over and over again in the editing process. That's when I wanted to drink.
What were some of the things you had the most fun doing?
One of the best was I wanted to sing and dance to my iPod in public. And what I decided to do is I got all black clothes. I got black body paint, and I painted my whole body entirely to be like a silhouette, just like the iPod commercials. And then I had my white iPod and my white earbuds, and I went dancing around the city listening to this song called Save Me by a band called Inspector Owl. I even danced in front of the Apple Store. But number one most fun thing, recording a song with my father. My dad, when I was 10 years old, he wrote a song called Oops Opes, which was about his cat, Oprah.
His cat's name, Oprah?
Yeah, his cat's name was Oprah. My dad's a weird guy. So, you know, I got together all my friends who had played in bands, and we went into the studio and spent a whole day there recording it. And my dad loved being in the recording studio. It was kind of one of those, like, dream come trues. He had always played guitar, but he had never been in a real studio, never with a real band.
Oops, oops, the chicken's in the barn now. Oops, oops, quit playing with your yarn now. Oops, oops, you don't give a darn now. Oops, oops.
I would go over to his house on weekends every now and then, unless my mom said he was sick, which meant he was drinking. He was an alcoholic, so it's kind of where I supposedly got that from. And on the weekends that I would go to visit him, he had his guitar and he played me the song, and it was hilarious, it was fantastic, it was cute, and it was kind of like he wrote this song about his cat as if his cat was a country cat, but his cat was really a city cat, it was an apartment cat. It was so weird, but it's one of those few memories I had of my dad. You know, it had an innocent feel to it, kind of a children's song. Really, the song's a lot deeper now that I'm an adult listening to it. It's kind of how the farm is falling apart. But at least the farmer has his cat to keep him company. And I guess at that time, my dad's life was kind of falling apart, but he had his cat to keep him company. Probably the worst thing, the hardest thing, was to actually go back to Cleveland in March and face the guy who, for 5 years of my life, had basically did a lot of horrible, horrible things to me.
What happened when you faced him?
Honestly, almost nothing at all. I've read books about facing childhood abusers. I've went to counselors about it, and nothing that they say prepares you for what it's like, because it's so different and unique for each person. It wasn't me personally. I was one of maybe like 5 or 6 kids in this neighborhood. And the more that I learned is this is something that had happened to my abuser, who was maybe like 8 or 9 years older than me, and it probably happened to the person before them, and it's just this weird never-ending chain that just continuously went on.
What happened to you as a person, not as an artist or not as someone who's going down and checking off a list, but what happened to you as a person as you would move through these things? Did you find yourself changing in any way, or is it only now that you look back and you say, wow?
I had hoped to have some huge epiphany and the weight would be off my shoulders and I'd be a genius and I'd figure out my life and where I'm going. And that didn't happen at all, actually. Changing, it's just a weird concept that I think people really focus on too much. I'll say that I understand myself a little better.
Well, Owen, I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you very much.
Check out a trailer for the movie and a lot of funny stills about Owen doing crazy things at our website, weekendamerica.org.
That's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our show's produced with Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Rob Byers, who is moving into his new apartment in Minneapolis after spending 2 weeks on Johnny Vince Evans' floor, Neely Allel, Millie Jefferson, E. Okobi, Sam Keenan, Michael Raphael, who will be helping Rob move into his Minneapolis apartment, Susie Lechtenberg, and Tim Bomba.
Also, Johnny Vince Evans, who's getting his floor back now that Rob's moving out, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Phyllis Owens, Angela Kim, John Moe, Shirley Shin, Michael May, Sandon Totten, and Mark Sanchez, who will be watching Johnny and Michael help Rob move into his new apartment.
Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the program. You can get a free podcast of today's show when you come spend some time with us. Look around at the images, the information, the links at our website, weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Hey, get out there and enjoy your weekend.
Oops, oops, the horse refused to stud now. Oops, oops, the cow won't give no cud now. Oops, oops, our whole darn farm's a dud now. Oh, oops, oops.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. This program is made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Picture this. It's Friday night or Saturday afternoon. You're home. No, wait. You're driving in your car. What song are you listening to?
It's really spastic, but it also has undertones of something a little bit more serious.
I'm on fire. I think I'm ready to bust a move.
I'm Bill Radke, the host of Weekend America. Join us each week as we capture the sound of your weekend.